On June 17, 1775, American colonial militias fought the British in the Battle of Bunker Hill. The colonists lost, but they put up such a good fight that Henry Clinton, the British general, noted a few more such victories would have shortly put an end to British dominion in America. In 1960, historian Thomas Fleming published Now We Are Enemies, the story of Bunker Hill, what many considered the definitive text on the battle. And now American History Press has issued a 50th anniversary edition. I'm very pleased that this occasion brings Thomas Fleming back to our show. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Well, it's a pleasure to see you, too, especially for this, one of my favorite topics.
Well, when the book came out in 1960, it was the first major work on the subject in 100 years.
That's right.
Which was a surprise at the time, considering how important this battle was. Have there been others since?
Oh, yes. There's been three or four other books on Bunker Hill. But this was what I think made this book such a got so much attention was it was the first time that someone had written about the revolution as a dramatic narrative. And Bruce Catton was my model, you might say, at the great Civil War historian, you know. And the revolution had been overshadowed as a military and dramatic story by the two world wars. And
this almost reads like a novel in some cases.
Well, I have written a lot of novels since I wrote this book, and I consider that a compliment. I really do. I tried to make it as I saw all the drama in it, and I tried to get it down on the page.
And you also drew upon the writings of other people at the time.
Oh, tremendous.
So we hear a wide range of voices here.
Oh, it's just so many different. There are not letters, diaries. That it was very rich. The amusing thing is, when I went to Boston originally to do the research, I was planning to write an article about Bunker Hill. I was one of the many who thought, oh, there's not much to this story. I know all about it. Don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into the real story, I was absolutely amazed and fascinated, and that's when I decided to make it a book.
And don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. Was it actually said on Bunker Hill?
Oh, yes, definitely. But nobody can agree on who said it.
Mm-hmm. It probably wasn't the first time it had been
issued. Well, no,
it was
an old saying that went back to 1745. What it really is, Leonard, is it's a tribute to the professionalism of the American officers who were in command of the American troops. These guys weren't all a bunch of raw amateurs, which is sort of the legend of Bunker Hill. These men, Putnam, John Stark, William Prescott, the three principal leaders, they were all colonels. They had fought in the French and Indian War. They were as close as we had to professional soldiers. And don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes was a way of saying, man, the muskets we've got are terrible weapons. They can't hit anything at more than 50 yards. So wait until the enemy is close and then pull the trigger.
But wasn't there a fear that the enemy, which had better weapons, might start shooting first?
No, because their muskets were just as bad. And the British, as a matter of fact, the word aim was not even in the British manual of arms. That shows how little interest anyone had in actually aiming a gun.
It was just ready fire?
It was just a massive blast with the hope that a couple of bullets would hit somebody.
Perhaps we should begin with where the Battle of Bunker Hill actually was fought, not on Bunker Hill.
Oh, that is one of the most fascinating things. Not long ago, I got a letter from a man named Breed. He wrote to me. I said, I'm an officer of the American Revolution Roundtable in New York. And he told me that he and his family had been trying for 100 years to get the name of this battle changed to Breed's Hill, which is where it was. But he said he's finally given up. He's just going to accept it as Bunker Hill.
Well, how did it wind up with the name Bunker Hill?
That was a nice piece of American propaganda. The Americans did not want to seem to be the aggressors in this battle, so they ordered the men who went out on Bunker Hill the night before the battle to build a fort on Bunker Hill, which was farther away from Boston. But Putnam and Prescott had no intention of building the fort on Bunker Hill. It was not going to force the British to attack them. And the whole point that they were sending those men out there was because we had found out that the British were planning to attack the Americans on June 18th, and this was a device to get the British to fight on ground of America's choosing, and it had to be built on Bunker Hill to do that because it was closer to Boston.
Well, in talking about the American Revolution, you say America provided the spark, but England provided the gunpowder. Sounds to me like both sides were sparking and getting gunpowder at the same time.
There's no doubt about it, but the crucial figure in this has been completely forgotten, Dr. Joseph Warren. He was the head of the Massachusetts Committee of Safety. He was a brilliant, handsome guy, and he was trying to negotiate some form of peace with the British commander in Boston, but the British had decided this thing was only going to be decided by gunfire. And so when the Americans put that fort on the hill, they could have said, oh, wait a minute, let's negotiate. They didn't. Instead, they sent 2,000 men over there to wipe it off the hill and decide it right then and there.
Well, what else was happening around Boston that led up to this battle?
Well, on April 19th, the gunfire broke out at Lexington, and then the British marched to Concord, and more gunfire broke out there, and then there was a running fight on the bunker, on the road from Lexington to Concord, and back from Concord to Lexington and back to Boston, and that was the first bloodshed, and a huge. Literally thousands of men from Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire rushed to surround the British in Boston. And there were 15,000 of them out there surrounding the Boston. And these were the men that the British hoped to disperse when they attacked on the 18th of June.
Well, Lexington and Concord occurred 2 months earlier than Bunker Hill. Did either side know it was at war by the time of the Bunker Hill battle?
No, they didn't, Olena, because they didn't. Lexington and Concord could have. It was best might best be described as an armed riot. No one intended on either side to have a shooting match, but Bunker Hill was a definite challenge to the British. They said Putnam and Prescott was saying. Our soldiers can stand up to your army in a formal battle. We're calling on you to meet this challenge or agree to peace.
Well, the supposed reason for all of this was a 3-cent tax that the British were levying on tea.
Yes.
Did the British need the money? Or was this just a way of saying, hey, we're in control here?
It was a way of saying they were in control. They had tried to tax the Americans in the previous decade several times, and there was such an uproar that they withdrew those taxes, but they retained this tax on tea, as George III said, to keep up the right. And the Americans were determined not to let them keep up that right, and that's why they threw the tea in the harbor.
Now, the current Tea Partiers cite their connection. Do you see any connection?
The current Tea Party people have no idea of the realities of the Tea Party of 1774 or three rather. It's a nice symbol, but they don't really connect it politically.
My guest is Thomas Fleming, whose Now We Are Enemies, The Story of Bunker Hill, was originally published 50 years ago. It's been reissued by American History Press with a new introduction and a new foreword. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Thomas Fleming, whose book, Now We Are Enemies, The Story of Bunker Hill, has just been reissued in the 50th anniversary edition by American History Press, and it has, as I said, a new introduction and a new foreword. Has any new information, important information, come up about the battle over the past half century?
Not really much new information, but I think the more we've thought about it and the more I've thought about it, we see the embryo of the whole American Revolution right here in this battle. And that's why I then, after writing this book, I then decided I would become a historian of the Revolution. This whole thing is such a fascinating synthesis of what the Revolution was all about.
Was there a unified sense of American identity or an American nationality in 1775?
We were rapidly approaching a sense of nationality. There's no way about it, no doubt about it. The word American began to be used to describe us around 1750. And this had been a growing thing, and we just were not ready to start letting the British take over various parts of our government. That's all there was to it.
So a sense of patriotism was developing?
Oh, definitely, yes. There was a huge sense of anger at the fighting at Lexington. But here's the crucial thing about Bunker Hill. At this point, most Americans did not think our army could stand up to the British Army, which was considered the best in the world. And Bunker Hill proved that this could be done, and that made the revolution a possibility.
Well, people around in the other colonies must have gotten word of what happened. How did they respond?
They responded to Bunker Hill with a huge excitement. George Washington was riding towards Cambridge to take command of this embryo army that was surrounding the city of Boston. And when he heard about the Battle of Bunker Hill, and according to the tradition, he said, did our men stand against the British fire? And when the answer was yes, he said, the liberties of our country are safe.
But the reports of casualties that George Washington received were understated, so he must have been more heartened than he should have been.
Well, he was somewhat intimidated by to learn that we did lose a fair number of men, but the crucial number was the British casualties. We had a lot of spies in Boston, the same people who had warned us against this British attack that was coming, and they soon revealed that British casualties at Bunker Hill were four times larger than the American casualties.
How did that play in England?
In England? It was a stunning shock to them.
Even though they won the battle?
Yes, they won the battle, but they saw it as a sort of thing that really was what they called a Pyrrhic victory, a victory that was really a defeat. And soon the Americans began to get the same idea. There was a Rhode Island general who said, "I hope we can sell them another hill in the next few days at the same price."
Now, how did Charleston, the peninsula where Bunker and Breed's Hills were located, become such a strategic location? And wouldn't it have been more important to the Americans if we'd had a real navy?
At this point, we didn't have an income. There was no money to build a navy because the Continental Congress had not moved to the point of actually forming a nation. So we didn't have a navy, but Charlestown was very important as a symbol more than anything else. It was called the mother of the colony. It was the first place that the British, that the Puritans settled after they landed in Boston, in and around Boston in 1630. And so it had a great symbolism. And when that city, or that town really, it's about 600 houses, was burned in the Battle of Bunker Hill, this triggered a former Bostonian named Benjamin Franklin to write the letter which I made into the title of my book. He sent it to a friend in England who was a member of Parliament, and he said, "We were long friends. You are now burning our houses and murdering our citizens. You are now my enemy, and I am yours, Ben Franklin." And he signed the letter.
Of the 115 Americans who died, only one was from Boston.
That is a very significant figure.
Yeah, what did that mean to the people back in England? Were they aware of that?
It meant that they had totally misjudged the temper of the whole colony of Massachusetts, and in fact the colonies of New England, the other New England colonies, because they all had come to Boston's defense. The British thought they could beat up on Boston for throwing the tea in the harbor, and no one else would do anything. Instead, they ignited rage all through New England, and that began to flow down into the rest of the nation.
Well, there were still many loyalists throughout the colonies, maybe more in New York than in Massachusetts, but did this split everybody?
There were always in New England, loyalists were relatively few, but in the other colonies there were a great many. But they were overshadowed by what they called the rage militaire, the military madness. Everywhere after Bunker Hill, there were people out drilling, companies, men forming regiments and companies, and there was no doubt that it had spread throughout all the colonies. And as I say, it's because they realized that independence and a response to the British was possible because we had shown we could defeat this British army.
So not just in New England, but also in the South?
Yes. There was what in the South?
Everybody started coming on board and thinking, we might actually have a war of independence here.
Yes. Washington has a very significant comment, which I have in the book. He said, I never thought of a moment for another moment of accommodation. He meant working out a truce with the British after the Bunker Hill fight. He was, of course, a Virginian, you know, and that he was nominated to be head of the army because they wanted to draw the southern colonies into this whole thing.
He also had his own experience as a leader during the French and Indian Wars.
He was another semi-professional soldier who had made quite a reputation in the French and Indian War.
In telling the narrative, you've let the characters speak for themselves, drawing upon lots of diaries that were letters from the time.
An amazing number of diaries and letters. There's the Massachusetts. It was interesting when I spoke up in Boston recently at the Massachusetts Historical Society. The chief librarian got out four of the letters that I quoted from, and he had them mounted in frames on the dais next to where I spoke. It was a very nice compliment to me and the book, but it was a good sample of how much historical riches there were about Bunker Hill up there.
Despite that, it's my sense that when your book was published, people were surprised to learn the real story. Many didn't even know that we'd lost the battle.
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, Leonard, I did a little poll. I asked 100 people, did we win the Battle of Bunker Hill? And 99 of them said, of course. That's the legend of Bunker Hill. The reality is what we've been discussing today.
Which is that we lost it, but in some ways we did win it.
We lost it, but we proved that we could win in terms of inflicting terrible damage on the British Army.
In your introduction to this new edition, you point out that the original book came out with the Korean War fresh in our memories.
Yes.
1960 was the year of the Kennedy-Nixon election. Kennedy would go on to win, and the country went through a major identity change. Thinking about the timing then and contrast to the timing now, do you see any new significance?
I think, again, we are locked in a war that some people are saying, can we win? And in 1960, it was the struggle with communism, which had erupted into terrible bloodshed in Korea and ended in a stalemate. And so that question was being asked then. We're now asking it again. I think it helps to realize that Bunker Hill is not simply an act of raw courage, but it is a tribute to America's military shrewdness and as well as courage.
And not everybody, by the way, showed courage. A fair number of people ran, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Well, this is true of every battle. There are always a certain number of people who can't deal with the terrible experience of combat, and there's nothing new about that. But again, it's worth reminding us, reminding ourselves, that just because some people run doesn't mean that the war can't be won.
Has your understanding of the battle changed over the past 50 years?
My understanding of the revolution?
Or this, the significance of it all, because you were obviously telling everyone at the time that this was a very significant moment.
Yes.
Has that pretty much solidified in your head? Or
It's deepened, if anything, because I went on to see how this played out throughout the whole revolution in terms of challenging this British army with a real army of our own. The revolution, contrary to what some people have said lately, was not a guerrilla war. It was a formal army that George Washington organized and led, and that's what won the war. And this is what we proved we could do at Bunker Hill.
Thomas Fleming is a prolific historian and novelist. He has... been a frequent guest on C-SPAN, the History Channel, PBS, also contributing articles to most of the major publications that deal with history. And his book, Now We Are Enemies, The Story of Bunker Hill, is one of the great classics of American history. It's now being celebrated with a 50th anniversary edition, and it is being published by American History Press. Thomas Fleming will also be in an interactive moderated discussion this Saturday through Monday. For more details about that, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today on our show. And happy 50th anniversary for this.
Well, thank you, Lennon. It's always such a great pleasure to chat with you.